Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kendall Roden, Cynthia Krang, Kale Teeter, Evan Vasilik, Russell Young, and Sajid DeMello discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please visit our website at azpodcast.com.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 299 being recorded on the 3rd of October, 2019, with special guest Harold Wong. I'm Sajid, and on Teams, we have Kendall, Evan, and of course, our special guest, Harold. And before we get to Harold in just a minute, why don't we just do a quick rundown on the news this past week. Been quite a busy week. There's been a bunch of items. Kendall, is there anyone that you like from here from this list?
Yeah, so I think probably my favorite update this week is that Azure Cosmos DB is basically bringing in recommendations to you on ways that you can optimize the way that you're using Cosmos, or maybe even just recommendations about if you're following some of the best practices around making sure that your SDK is upgraded or that you have your collections partitioned properly. So yeah, I think that there's some really cool stuff just in terms of how we're integrating a lot of these kind of best practice recommendations through Azure Advisor, and then also making it even like notifications that are going to hit you when you're in your Cosmos DB account in the Azure portal. So I think it's pretty neat that we're just trying to help customers optimize the way that they're using our services. So that one's definitely one that gets me really excited.
Yeah, and related to that one, Kendall, is also with Cosmos DB, these Cosmic Notebooks. I don't know if you've seen that one,
but yeah, so they've extended.
Yeah, they've extended like the Jupyter Notebooks to Cosmos DB now, and so you know you could get that free form query kind of syntax that we love in Jupyter Notebooks. You could query a Cosmos DB database. You can visualize it. You know, run some transformations, etc. Right from inside of the portal itself. So you just click on the Data Explorer, and you can, and then there is a query window there, and you can do all these fun things. So I think that's something
so
I need to.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm looking at it now, and I'm kind of geeking out. Like my smile is so big. That is so cool. It's baked right in too to Cosmos in the portal.
Exactly. Yep. Whoa. Evan, is there anything that caught your eye this week?
Yeah, so two of them. One's very, very self-serving. I meant to mention it previously, but if it hasn't, I know we haven't talked about it before, but the Azure engineering team is now hiring and staffing in Atlanta. I actually have a direct report down there. I just came out of an interview for a position down there, or giving an interview, not moving to Atlanta myself. But if there's folks out there that are interested in the area, check out Microsoft Jobs and search for CXP ATL and Azure in Atlanta, and there's a lot of opportunities coming. The other piece is the Windows Virtual Desktop, right? This is the product. Forget the self-serving one. The Windows Virtual Desktop went generally available. Like this is basically, if you think about the traditional on-premises remote desktop services solution, this is that, but at massive scale, living within Azure, right? Which, if you're doing a remote desktop, you don't really care where it is, right? If you're doing a VDI solution, and this is a great, great use of Azure and a great, great use of kind of the power of leverage combining Microsoft and Office. It's optimized for Office 365, so combining it with Office and Azure at that point, right? It's just really, really neat implementation to see finally go GA.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and that's going to open up a lot of use cases for our customers that want to expose their, keep their workstations in their own VNet, attach it to their on-premise systems, etc. So definitely
absolutely.
A big one there.
Yeah, I would say even for partners, not just customers, but there's a lot of partners that build solutions that require remote desktop type services. And so this is going to open a lot of kind of doors and opportunities for them as well.
Absolutely. Yep.
All right, Harold. And Harold, since we since you chimed in over there, there's another update this week, which I thought you might be you might have a vested interest in, and that is the partnership by Microsoft and Swift. Would you like to share some of your thoughts around that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you use Swift today, then you know that there's a lot of like real tough requirements around hardware and where the hardware sits, and it becomes expensive in that from that perspective. And the fact that Swift is now putting some of that infrastructure into Azure makes it a lot easier for customers who want to use the Swift backbone to deploy things in a easier manner, hopefully faster manner, and secure in that it's in Azure and you don't have to worry about putting some kind of a device in its own room and its own network and so forth, right? So we've been working very closely with Swift to enable that kind of a capability. So as you see this continue to grow, you'll see more and more financial institutions, hopefully, as well, that will expand and start doing things more in the cloud in conjunction with the Swift infrastructure sitting in the cloud. And when I say cloud, I specifically mean Azure.
that sounds a lot like we were – I think we talked a couple of episodes ago with Matt Small about hosting KMS or HMS, hardware key management solutions in Azure. This sounds very similar, right, in the sense of there is some element of hardware that's sitting there that makes it happen, but you're now able to have a kind of self-service on-demand access to that using Azure.
Yeah, very similar. And eventually we'll start tapping into that hardware-based HMS as well for the solution. So
Awesome.
At least that's the hopes, right? Everything ties together, so it's all great.
Yeah. Another update this week was on the direct upload to Azure Managed Disks. Currently, if you want to upload your disk to Azure, you can stage the VHD in the storage account and then convert it into a managed disk, right? Or you can create an empty managed disk, attach it to a VM and do some sort of copy to it. Both of those are painful. They take time and it's not really what you want to do. Basically, what you want to do is to take your on-prem VM or VHD and directly send it into Azure. And now this new feature, Direct Upload to Azure, lets you do that. You could use the new Azure Storage Explorer, which coincidentally has also been updated this week, version 1.10. And so you can use that to have that new functionality directly in Azure Storage Explorer. What else? Anything else that I missed this week? Covered the storage, virtual desktop. Yep, I think that's a good roundup, right?
Yep, looks good.
All right, Glenn, let's turn the mic over to our special guest, Harold. Harold, thank you so much for joining us. Harold actually is a colleague of mine. We're on the same team at Microsoft, but I'll let him introduce himself. He's been at Microsoft a long time. Harold, go ahead.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So my name is Harold Wong. I am a principal software engineer on the commercial software engineering team. As Sujit said, I'm on pretty much the same team as him. We have the same manager. I just happen to cover Red Hat, right? Have been working on that Red Hat partnership for the last 3.5, almost 4 years now. So been involved in a lot of different things that are Red Hat related, especially as it fits in with the Azure picture.
So what kind of products that that Red Hat might have would be of interest to us, right, or to Azure for that matter? Like, what's the kind of crossover that we're talking about here?
So containers, right? If you look at the last 2 to 3 years, I would say containers is probably one of the biggest topics all up everywhere. So you see AKS on our side, and then on the Red Hat side, they have OpenShift, which they tout as the enterprise Kubernetes, right? And it is. It has a lot of features that are based on top of Kubernetes, but then they built a lot of additional features on top of that. And so when you look at running OpenShift on-prem or running it in a public cloud, what we did about 18, oh, I guess now it's been 2 years ago, we started work with Red Hat OpenShift Engineering to get a first-party OpenShift service in Azure that is jointly developed and jointly supported and run by Microsoft and Red Hat engineers and support staff. And so that GA'd in May during Red Hat Summit, when that was announced with Satya on stage and everything back on May 7th, I think it was, or 8th in Boston. So that's probably the biggest piece, right? There's a lot of other things that are going on, but I would say that's probably one of the biggest pieces that we have going on with Red Hat right now, especially when you look at a first party service in Azure.
So, maybe it's just me being asking a naive question here, but I have not worked directly with OpenShift. and I've heard about a lot of good things about it. Maybe give our listeners like a quick cliff notes as to, you know, what exactly is OpenShift and what exactly does it provide on top of, say, a standard vanilla Kubernetes installation.
Yes, absolutely. So first off, I do want to say that OpenShift isn't something you install on top of vanilla Kubernetes, right? So when you install OpenShift, it includes Kubernetes. So the installation already lays down a portion of Kubernetes or lays down Kubernetes, right? So it's built on top of, and you can't do OpenShift without it, but you don't install Kubernetes and then install OpenShift on top of it. But what Red Hat has done with the OpenShift product has, they've done a lot in terms of making it developer focused. So they built in years ago the source to image capability. They built in like integrated pipelines for a given project, or you can have pipelines that you can use across multiple projects. They did a lot around integrated authentication and security and RBAC controls. So even before Kubernetes had the concept of RBAC, OpenShift already had all of that, right? So they, in order to be enterprise ready, you had to make sure that only certain people could do certain things in your cluster. And so Red Hat built that in many, many years ago, right? And that all of that work then got pushed up into upstream Kubernetes. So then all the RBAC stuff, I would say, was based on a lot of the work that Red Hat did from OpenShift. But they have a great, I guess, experience for the developer. So it's not just, hey, you can go run containers, but they actually put things in place so that it makes it easier for a developer to immediately get started in terms of doing source to image builds, or to say, well, I've got my project in GitHub and I just want to be able to get a container out, right? I don't have to, as a developer, worry about how do I build my container, right? I can just let OpenShift take care of a lot of those underpinnings for me, right? And so OpenShift makes it easier for that developer to just get started deploying things into QA, into dev, and then also makes it a lot easier then to then move into production.
So, go ahead, Kendall.
Go ahead, Evan. No, you're good.
So Harold, maybe I'm just missing something here, but if I'm doing containers and, you know, Kubernetes with that, like, how do I decide, hey, I should go use OpenShift, or I should use AKS, or even, you know, other third-party ones that are out there? Like, I mean, it sounds like there's pros and cons to each. What are the kind of things that are most likely to drive me towards OpenShift?
Very good question. I get asked that quite a bit, right? And aside from the technology or the features that OpenShift has versus vanilla Kubernetes, the first thing that I generally see, but has nothing to do with the technology per se, but everything to do with, I need official support, right? So very common in government entities, right? All of those with three-letter acronyms. Generally, community support is not acceptable, right? In order to pass whatever the audits are, you need a product or a solution that has a support mechanism in place. And so with Red Hat, it is really, or with OpenShift, it really comes down to support, right? First and foremost, at least from what I've seen on the Microsoft side. I'm sure there's a lot more that goes into that. But if I'm going to run Kubernetes, then who supports it? It's not Google that supports it. It's not necessarily Microsoft that supports it. Is it an in-house company or in-house group of technical staff? But then there's no SLA. Who's going to really give me that, hey, I have a enterprise entity that I can go to get patches, to get fixes, right? And that's where OpenShift really shines, is Red Hat.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I mean, I totally get open source. There's scenarios that I use open source, but, you know, I always kind of, when I look at it, I always, you know, when my back's to the wall and I need somebody who is an expert at fill in the blank to fix it for me, I do want to be able to call somebody.
Yep. And when you look at, I think it was about a year ago now, there was a CVE that, you know, 0-day vulnerability in Kubernetes that the community, right, upstream said, well, you know, we're not going to go back and patch all the older versions, right? So either you upgrade and completely get rid of, you know, the version that was all affected and move to Kubernetes, I think it was 1.13 at the time, then What happens to companies that are running in production on an older version? What do they do, right? There was no fix available. But if you were an OpenShift customer with Red Hat, Red Hat actually patched all the way back to their 3.4 or 3.5 at the time, right? That which meant Kubernetes 1.4, 1.5. I mean, they went back multiple versions, multiple years worth, and patched all of those. Right? You wouldn't get that if you were just running vanilla Kubernetes. You would have said, okay, what do I have to do to get to the current version of Kubernetes so that I don't have that vulnerability affecting me?
Right. Yeah. And neither of them are wrong. They're just different ways to run a business, right?
Exactly.
For some people, that stability of I don't want to change my version is the primary driver. For other people, hey, I want to be on the latest and greatest at all times, and that's how I'm going to get my, you know, my fixes and whatnot.
Correct. And so that's like usually a big piece. But the other ones also, you need to look at how is it that your developers are going to deploy their containerized workloads either into dev test or into QA or production, right? So what tool sets do you want to use? What's the mechanism that you're using? How do you do your pipelines, right? What kind of integration are you doing? And so that, as you dig into it, you may find that, well, maybe, you know, upstream vanilla Kubernetes is fine. In a lot of instances, you might find that, well, I really do want that OpenShift experience and that solution. And that's what's going to drive you.
Makes sense.
So when it comes to OpenShift, I know it's a little bit different than AKS in the sense that, you know, with AKS, you need to integrate some kind of like image registry in that you're going to set up separate from that. But my understanding is maybe OpenShift has all of that kind of package together. So you're not necessarily going to be using like Azure Container Registry. You'd actually use something that comes with OpenShift. Is that the case? And can you just talk a little bit about some of what's bundled in that maybe you would get with Red Hat OpenShift that you might not get with AKS per se?
Yeah. So when you look at OpenShift, just in general, you're right. They do bundle in or include in a registry, right? It's a Docker compliant registry, all of that. And it's included in the cluster. It runs as a pod. And you can use Azure Storage to back end that so that you're still using Azure if you're running this in Azure, right? And the beauty of that is it's integrated. The authentication is integrated. And you can push to it. You can pull from it, right? So all, the source to image process, by default, well, the only registry it can use is that integrated registry. It also has an integrated router, which is essentially an HA proxy or a set of HA proxy pods that run within the cluster that make it a lot easier to expose applications publicly or even internally. So when you deploy your application, right, the OpenShift just makes it a lot easier to expose routes, right, or expose your application via HTTP or HTTPS. Right, those are the two key things. And if you really like that, it's a huge plus. If it's something you don't really care that much about, then it really doesn't come into play, right? And then when you look at Arrow specifically, which is Azure Red Hat OpenShift, the managed service, you're right. It does come with those pieces by default automatically.
And maybe this is wrong as well, but does Red Hat have any kind of like option to integrate a service mesh more like in the box instead of
absolutely
so
if you're running OpenShift as IaaS where you're self-managing it, then you can integrate Istio or many different meshes, right? So it's not that you can't. And in 4.2 or 4.3, I think Istio will become one of the default things that you can select from during deployment.
Okay, you were about to touch on the Azure side. Okay.
Yeah, so on the Arrow piece, which is our first-party managed or fully managed service, right now that's not there. Right?
Okay.
So you cannot set up your own service mesh. And even now, when you look at Arrow, the managed offering is based on 3.11, right? And in OpenShift 3.11, Istio was still a technology preview, right, or in beta. It wasn't technically GA yet, so it wouldn't be officially supported.
So is the goal to eventually get to like, is there going to be a cadence of like how many versions behind will be in Azure? Do you know if there's kind of what that cadence looks like?
Well, the goal for Azure, for Arrow, right? So specifically for Arrow will be N-1.
Okay.
Right. But with that said, when you look at 4.x, where Red Hat is on 4.2 right now for OpenShift, and for OpenShift's or for Azure support, 4.2 is in beta, right? So they're working on that. So when it GAs, then it will officially support Azure as a public cloud. But today it doesn't. So then for Aero to incorporate 4.2 probably won't be until the 4.2 comes out, or maybe even 4.3. Because, of course, with a fully managed service, there's a lot of work that goes into to play to make sure that from a support perspective, right, that making sure you understand from an ops perspective, all of that, you've gone through the proper testing. So there's always going to be a little bit of a lag in that respect as well.
So I have one more quick question, and then I'll hand it back over to the other gentleman on the call. But what is there a Windows story here? I mean, I know Red Hat is obviously, you know, very Linux heavy. So like, is there a Windows container story? Is there even just like kind of for customers who have a lot of Windows experience, like, is there a ramp path or a potential path forward to use Red Hat OpenShift? Or would you say that one of the big value propositions is customers who are already running Red Hat can then, you know, use this as their orchestrated choice?
Absolutely. With our partnership, there definitely has been work done to ensure that Windows container support in OpenShift is there as well. Right? And so you saw that is available in Kubernetes upstream. And that, of course, is being pulled in and being worked on for OpenShift. I'm thinking the official GA support for Windows containers and OpenShift, IaaS-based, right, self-managed, will be in 4.3. And then that should hopefully mean that from the Aero perspective, the fully managed service in Azure, 4.3 should also have it there. But I can't speak for sure, right, because that's a timeline that's probably into the early calendar year 2020 before that happens in terms of the managed service. But I would foresee that it would definitely be there in Aero as well.
Awesome. Okay, I was just kind of curious on that path. So thanks.
Oh yeah, many customers have been asking for that, for sure.
So Harold, I'm sure you know like a typical OpenShift installation might require a fair amount of resources. So give us an idea for what the installation experience might be, right? Is it something you just pop over to the portal and do it, or what can customers expect in terms of licensing, et cetera, for something like Aero?
So when I'll hit on the deployment experience first, right? So when we first launched Aero, the deployment experience was from the Azure CLI. You literally would do AZ, OpenShift, create, and then your different options, right? Not as many options that you could have selected as you can in AKS, but definitely for OpenShift, it was still a very simple experience in that I decided what I wanted, I initiated the command, and then probably within 14 minutes, I had a fully stood up OpenShift cluster 3.11 ready to go. Right. And so now I believe, and I need to double check this, but I believe you can now have do the same deployment via the portal, the GUI. Right? So, but the deployment experience is very straightforward, very simple. I would say kind of AK-ish like. Fewer options once again, right? Because we locked down it since it's fully managed. There are certain things we cannot enable or we can't turn on because it's a fully managed service when we can't afford to let the customers do something that would ultimately take down the cluster.
And what do you get when you do that default? Like how many nodes or whatever you get?
So the default cluster today for 3.11 would be 3 masters, 3 infrastructure nodes, and then 4 worker nodes.
Wow, that's a big cluster.
Yes.
Okay.
It is.
and then so, you know, maybe we're going to kind of segue into, you know, like, can anyone do this, or is there something that we need to any special requirements that customers have to have before they can issue this command? Any sort of enabling of for subscriptions?
Yeah, absolutely. So that is one of the contention points today, right? And today being October 3rd, we are at a point where before you could deploy a cluster, your Azure subscription needs to be enabled or turned on in order to deploy this cluster. And before that happens, customers do need to make an upfront purchase of what's called reserved instances in the value of $16,000. Right? And then we will enable their subscription, and they can deploy not only one Aero cluster, but they can deploy as many as they like at that point. But the initial investment would be a $16,000 upfront purchase of reserved instances. We are looking to get rid of that requirement, but that just takes time, right? And we're also evolving or growing or learning as a ops team to make sure that as 1,000 cluster spins up, that we should be able to handle that with no problem.
Okay, so that's just so that we can pre-allocate the kind of infrastructure required for a typical ARO installation. Is that
correct?
Where that's coming from?
That's partially part of it, right? Because as we start expanding our footprint reach into different regions, we do, like you said, need to make sure that we have the appropriate resources to deploy and support the number of clusters that our customers are going to ask for. Same thing as what happened when AKS was in its early infancy, right? There are certain requirements for how AKS worked. There's certain requirements for how Aero works. And so we just need to make sure that the hardware is there and that we're not going to hit any bottlenecks so that the experience is as good as possible.
Excellent. Okay, that's great. So what are the plans for Aero, like that you can share with our listeners? What can they expect? You've mentioned you've given us some hints in terms of being able to keep up with the versions, with the Kubernetes versions. What or like in terms of other stuff like VNet integration or other enterprise style requirements? What else can we expect from Aero in the months to come?
Yeah, the largest request for Aero today is around private clusters, right? A Aero cluster that is completely private, no public interfaces, and that is something we are working hard and heavy on. As you can imagine, think about a fully managed service where we need to be able to reach in and manage the VMs or the VM scale sets and the instances themselves. If we don't have a way to reach in and manage those servers, then it is hard to have a managed service, right? And so it's a interesting challenge, right? Because customers want us to fully manage that cluster, but have no public endpoints for us to reach the cluster from. So that does become a little bit of a challenge, right? And so we are working through all of those to ensure that there is a way for us to still manage those clusters without exposing any public endpoints. And so definitely being worked on. I just don't have a good timeline for when that will release.
Okay. And if customers are already using OpenShift today, maybe on-prem or through an IaaS, a self-managed experience, is there any hints or tips for them as they move to Aero? I know there's the version lag currently, but other than that, are there any things that they need to take into account when moving from the, let's say, an unmanaged to a managed version of this service?
Well, I would highly encourage people to go take a look at the documentation that we do have on Aero, because there are certain things that you are not going to be able to do, right? If I'm running my own self-managed cluster, and I absolutely need to run some containers as root or privileged containers, right? Then I can do that, right? Because I own the cluster and I can make changes to the cluster. In a fully managed cluster, we can't let you do that. So we will not allow containers to run as root or in privileged mode, right? That's just one of the most common things I've seen. Also today, customers are asking for more admin type control over their cluster or access to the cluster. And as it sits today, we're way more restrictive. So as time progresses, we will open up and enable more cluster admin type capabilities. But today you do need to look and make sure that the restrictions that we have in place, as you're deploying things to your self-managed cluster, if you're trying to make that switch eventually to a fully managed cluster, to ensure that your workloads or the things that you're doing don't require capabilities that you don't have access to in the managed offering. That's the biggest one.
Got it. Okay, great. Well, Harold, this has been very, very informative. Thank you so much for getting our listeners up to speed on this, on both on OpenShift as well as the Azure Red Hat OpenShift or ARO service that is currently being rolled out. If you have any links or documents you want to share with me, please send them over to me, and then I'll put them along with the show notes with this recording. And this way, our listeners will have that. And anything else you want to any last parting notes before we sign off here?
No, that's really all I have, and I will definitely share links to documentation with you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.